Welcome back to the Tower Hill Podcast with Pat and Mike Kilner. Before I introduce our guest on the podcast today, I wanted to take a moment to again mention the Kilner Group's upcoming scholarship competition for young entrepreneurs. We are awarding $10,000 to the local student or student group with the best idea and presentation for a new business. From the many excellent entries we received before the submission deadline back in November, we've chosen the five finalists who will be presenting their ideas in person to our panel of judges on December 28th. For more details and to see our list of sponsors, visit kilnergroup.com/scholarship. So, on to the episode at hand. Our guest this week is Phil Sotuk, formerly a successful corporate leader in the automotive industry, who founded his own international company in the automotive space in 2008. Phil is also an active investor and advisor in two startups. Phil was kind enough to join Pat and I over Skype for this interview to talk about his endeavors. Enjoy.
So Phil Sotuk, just a quick introduction on Phil, if I can do it quickly, because he's got so much on his plate. Phil Sotuk is the president and founder of Venture Source Corporation, a global supplier of specialized products to the automotive industry, founded in 2008, so not that long ago. It now has offices in Zeeland, Michigan, Shanghai, China, Monterrey, Mexico, and a little city in Spain called Barcelona. Earlier this year, Phil launched another company, DPMC North America, a management consultancy specializing in management by missions and virtuous leadership. Prior to these endeavors, he worked in various engineering, finance, and international business development roles for Chrysler, Manga, and Prince Corporation. He has his BS degree in economics and mathematics from Hope College. Love those hard sciences. And his MBA from the Thunderbird, American Graduate School of International Management. He also speaks Spanish and Portuguese, in addition to English, as you'll hear. Mm-hmm. In addition to providing leadership and strategic direction to VentureSource and DPMC, Phil is also an active investor and advisor in two startups, which I think is just great for the crowd that we're offering this to, because you're all going to learn so much about his mentality towards startups. And finally, one of these is a platform for learning, an online platform, right, Phil?
Yeah, that's correct.
In West Michigan, it provides educational services to corporations, schools, and nonprofits. And the other is a social enterprise in Guatemala City that provides local artisans access to a global marketplace. So really cool stuff. A lot to go over here. No way we could possibly cover all of this, Phil, in one short podcast, but thank you for joining us today, Phil, and appreciate you hanging in there with our technical difficulties this morning.
No, guys, it's my pleasure.
So Phil, let's just jump right in. Can you share a little bit about how you went from your education? I know you got an MBA, and your life then in the corporate world in sort of a cubicle setting to running an international family of companies.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I simply set out in the beginning to accomplish what people around me were telling me I needed to accomplish. So I had a very successful father and brother that was in business and surrounded by friends that were aspiring to do great things. And so as I, went out from high school into college, I started getting these ideas of what success looked like. And that included grad school and maybe some international travel, learning some languages, getting the right types of jobs and internships. So, from that age of 18 on, I was starting to plan, what my life might look like. As I think many kids do. There's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
So I think that was healthy in a sense. But, I guess I never necessarily set out to find a cubicle in a large organization, but that was kind of the path. It was get good grades coming out of undergrad, get a good first job that gives you a platform to get into grad school, and then land that big job at a big company, maybe get on a rotation program or something impressive like that. And that's what I was able to do. So in that sense, that was successful. But I think about 4 or 5 years into that first job, which was at Chrysler Corporation in the late 90s, Chrysler Corporation was going gangbusters. They were selling, you know, more Jeep Grand Cherokees than they could make. Mm. They were expanding globally. So Chrysler was hiring from grad schools, Thunderbird being one of them. They were looking for people with international skill sets and language capabilities. So I landed there. But, you know, 4 or 5 years into that, I guess I started questioning that whole plan that I had set out on a few years back. And I don't know what started bubbling up, but I started noticing an entrepreneurial spirit in me. I had a lot of conversations with people about what starting a business might entail and what that looked like and the challenges and so forth. So I started to kind of shift from let's get this big company experience to, well, maybe I'll just get experience that'll help me someday start a business. I thought that was for me, that was more challenging to start a business from scratch was more challenging than climbing a corporate ladder. And one of the things I was learning at Chrysler, I'm not going to fault them, was what I was learning at Chrysler was very specific to Chrysler. Mm. And so all the development that I was getting was essentially how to succeed within this organization. And that was one organization on the planet. So I started to think like, how beneficial is this if I ever leave someday or, you know, maybe I get let go. And so that started to rattle around in my head too, is not necessarily the best thing. So anyhow, so I started to shift that toward thinking entrepreneurially. And it was lucky because right about that time, the person that hired me into Chrysler, he left to take a CFO role at a big automotive tier one. And he pulled a couple of us over, me being one of them. And he put me in charge of what was their emerging markets. Mm. So I had Brazil and China responsibility, which probably most importantly, China, because that was right around 2000 and China was coming onto everybody's radar as the place to be. And so as I'm doing the course of business of, you know, managing the JVs that we had over there, I'm talking to people, I'm seeing new businesses, I'm seeing things just sprout up, and I'm in the back of my head saying, maybe there's a business model in here somewhere. And so jump forward a couple of years, that's essentially what I did. I just kind of started to craft a business model around the experience that I had. And that was, initially how Venture Source was born.
So
with that experience.
And it's a really kind of interesting theme throughout this that, and frankly, I think this is common for most entrepreneurs, this desire to go get more experience that you mentioned, right? The experience out that couldn't be offered to you within Chrysler. Frankly, heck, if Chrysler had been able to satiate that for you and allow you to be more of an entrepreneur at a high level, you may still, well, maybe not, but you probably would have had a longer time frame with them potentially. And just it's an interesting thing. And then a movement, you know, kind of keeping your eyes open for opportunity allows you to go out, strike out with a friend, and that relative to starting your own company is a fairly small risk to go out with a friend in another venture who's senior to you and it's just a great stepping stone. So I it's really interesting to me to hear sort of that progression of big corporate entity, smaller entity with some security, and then going totally out on your own with Venture Source.
Yeah, I mean, it was a small sidestep from the original plan. It wasn't too courageous in that sense. It was still very calculated with, okay, let's do this first and let's do that. So, I mean, I'm an engineer, so I'm pretty linear. So it was planned out that way, and I took calculated jumps along the way. But I also was trying to gain enough experience and enough worldly knowledge to give myself a chance if I was going to eventually make that jump. Because I think, again, and you know, I didn't think about it this way like I'm talking about it now. This is all in hindsight. But I think in the back of my head, I knew that once I do this, there's no turning back. Like I'm not going to try and start a company and then 5 years later try to get back into corporate world. It was like hell or high water for me. I was going to.
You're in.
It's like, if I do this, I'm doing it.
Awesome.
So that, you know, that was part of it. It wasn't whimsical.
Yeah.
So Phil, you mentioned the start of Venture Source. So can you tell us a little bit about some of your biggest lessons in building Venture Source as an international manufacturing operation, really from the ground up?
Yeah, I mean, and just since 2008. So, I mean, this is relatively a short time to go international pretty quickly. So, I'd love to hear about that.
Just how we, just some of the experiences in starting that.
Yeah, what are your biggest lessons? I mean, you know, as people that are constantly looking for ideas of how to grow businesses, what have you seen? I mean, you've scaled really quickly.
Yeah, you know, I can give many. I'll give a few of that are kind of top of mind and probably very relevant to entrepreneurs. But some of the biggest lessons, if I had to do it again, and these can be pretty practical too, so just bear with me, but it's never too soon to start talking to banks and start developing relationships with banks and lenders once you get, you know, get out there and get this thing started. So I was fortunate because I had started, I was incubated, so to speak, by another company. So I was insulated a little bit from that. And that was good and bad. What was good about it is I had a company that was essentially saying, we'll help you get started. And so that was great. The flip side of that is it made me a little bit lazy in developing those relationships that I was going to need once we were, you know, more on our own. And so that's one thing that in hindsight I would do from day one is start to structure those relationships. Because once you need funding, whether it's growth capital or working capital, it's really difficult to get it when you're in that position of growth and you need it.
Set it up ahead of time.
Set it up as much as you can ahead of time. Now that's difficult to do in a startup because you have nothing to show.
Yeah.
But you have to start those conversations and get people knowing about your business and understanding your planning and how you're going to get there and just getting comfortable with that. So you shorten the time to cash when you actually need it.
So that incubation period, if you don't mind me asking, how long was the incubation period?
You know, it was, you know, it could have been, I think it was like 3 to 4 years that, we really didn't need to have a banking relationship. Part of the reason was we were leveraging their bank. Mm. So it was kind of like they were giving us intercompany loans and types of things like that, which was leveraging their line of credit. And then at the point in time where we're like, okay, now we have to break, we sat down with the banks and they're like, we need like 3 years worth of, you know, credibility from you guys. You can't, we can't just sign you up. And so I had to pump a bunch of personal money into it and bridge some gaps. And it was a little bit stressful, but we got back on track. But it was crazy because at that point in time, we were more than a startup too. And we were still having a hard time banking. So
because they see you as a dependent company, not an independent company at that point.
Exactly. We didn't necessarily have a track record with another bank that they could. Banks are very conservative these days, as you know. Mm-hmm. So they like to see that somebody else banked with you for 3 years. They're like, okay, we'll bank with you too. It's like, great, thanks.
Yeah. So if you go back, would you not incubate at all? Would you just incubate for a very short period of time?
I think I would incubate. I wouldn't even necessarily recommend shortening the incubation. I think incubation is unique to whatever your business is and who you're working with. I think I would just start planning for that separation way sooner than I did, and planning for going out on your own way. So it's like a any type of succession plan. You don't start planning for succession, you know, 3 months before the owner of the company wants to transition. He's doing this years in advance and developing that. So it's that type of thing is right from the get-go, plan for that point of departure.
It's a great lesson. Great lesson. Yeah.
So yeah, and a couple other things. I would say it took us probably 5 years too long and too many mishires to realize the importance of character and the character traits that worked in our business. and every business is unique. It requires certain types of temperaments in people, but figuring out what those are or what those might need to be for the type of business that you're in is very helpful in seeking people that are going to succeed within your business, because it's a two-way street. You know, what you're offering them as an employer, but you have to be seeking people that will flourish within your organization. And in order to understand if they're going to flourish, you need to understand what types of character traits and temperaments are needed to be successful in your business. And we just took too long to figure that out. We were hiring for skill, but they didn't have the right character traits. And so it was pretty frustrating for a period of time. We started to say that entitled employees suck. They suck all the time.
Yeah.
Because we bring in people with capabilities and skill sets that have been around the block for 10 years, and they don't fit the culture, or they don't meet the character traits or behaviors that your culture is trying to develop, and it's miserable. So you
would, in retrospect, take character over skill now?
I think I would, yeah. I think I would. You hear it a lot. It's very cliche, character over skill, character wins. Mm-hmm. I do think there is, and I want to be brutally honest with entrepreneurs, there is a time in your startup where you might just have to hire for skill and suck it up because that you absolutely need that credibility, and you're just going to have to keep telling yourself that, you know, we just need this person here. And it sounds pretty crass, but I mean, there's some survival skills that just need to kick in some of those cases. It's really, culture is a thing that is a difficult thing to develop. And I think you just have to go into it with a reality of, there will be times where, you know, we may need to hire people that are just about the skill.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that they can't be led entirely, but they may not be the ideal in terms of character that you want to have once you're at a mature state as a company.
Yeah, and what helps is, again, if you know the types of character traits that ought to be successful in your organization, knowing is half the battle. So you can work with people that maybe don't fit that. I wouldn't call us a startup. We went through a hire in the last year where we brought a guy in for 18 months, and we absolutely needed his skill set, and we knew that we needed his skill set, and we all agreed that his character traits probably didn't fit what our culture was, and we were going to work with that. And we laid that out to him coming in, saying, this is who we are. These are the types of behaviors we expect. We had to have a couple of conversations with him for language in the office and some of that type of stuff, but it was manageable. And at the end of the day, it didn't really hurt our culture. So it was a win-win.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Great. So that's, you know, VentureSource, obviously, it seems, those are your two, you know, never too early to talk to banks, character over craft or skill, if you will. And that's been the foundation.
More, but I don't need to go through more. I don't need to go through more. There's more if you want, but
no, I think there's so much there though. Those two are two of the first things out of your mouth is, you know, you got to get great people and you got to have funding. And we hear that all the time. You know, no matter how big or small the company is.
You know, one more I would add, if we're talking, you know, if entrepreneurs are listening to this, is the power of collaboration. We collaborated out of necessity in the beginning because we had to. We had nothing else. Now we have more things are vertically integrated. We do more things in-house. But learning that craft of collaborating well internally and externally as you're starting your business can be very powerful and can really accelerate it if you embrace looking for those other organizations or other businesses that might, you know, if you put together, it might be a 1 + 1 = 3 type of thing. So open your eyes to, you know, can we really get here on our own, or maybe is a collaborative approach a better way to accelerate getting to where we want to get to?
Yeah, a JV or something like that. That's great.
Yeah, we JV'd in Europe, for example, to go to Europe, because otherwise we would have had to to learn it ourselves, I guess, to a certain degree. So we JV'd with an existing small enterprise over there that had a skilled team, and it worked out great.
That's great to create that win for both sides. And I know that you've mentioned to me before, that's when we first met, that you took the company VentureSource international faster than other people were advising you to. Was that a result of just finding great partnerships, great JVs? You know, if you could go back and do it again, would you maybe have taken that advice and not gone so fast out into the international market?
No, I think I would have done it again. Mm-hmm. I think I would do the same. Part of that, though, was my background. That was where my expertise was, so to speak. You know, I came from an international grad school. I did international placements with Chrysler and Magna International Corporation, the second company I worked. So I had that. I looked at that as kind of like a competitive advantage. Like, if we can leverage this international thing sooner than others might, then maybe we can get a global footprint and be able to talk to tier ones and OEMs with a little more credibility. So that was part of the strategy. So I think I would do that again. But, you know, part of that was, I don't know if you remember The World is Flat, that book that came out in the early 2000s. We had, you know, I and a couple of my leaders had read that book. And so we were all gung-ho on that business model of, you know, you can leverage these other organizations around the world and create some winning business models. So we kind of set out to do that right from the get-go. It was just part of our overarching strategy was to go global. But, you know, and then that manifests itself in DPMC, which you'd mentioned at the beginning. That's another joint venture with a Spanish firm. And then OOTS, which is our Guatemalan social enterprise. That's an investment in an enterprise down there of four entrepreneurs that wanted to start something. So we just, I don't know, it's just kind of like, that's our talent. So if that's our talent and we seem to do it well, let's keep adding to that and figuring out how we can leverage that. So if for our advisors, they were hesitant and they were like, man, you know, that's twice the risk, three times the risk if you try to do something, but they weren't necessarily coming from that background. So of course they were a little bit nervous about it. But China, I will tell you, China was a headache and still is a headache. Hmm. So it's not like everything we did globally was roses. It was, we learned some hard lessons along the way.
Does being in China though allow you to tell a different story? Does it add to your cache of stories, if you will, as you're talking to other international clients? Does that help?
Absolutely. It's a badge of honor. Mm. It really is, because everybody knows how difficult it is to do business there and to maintain a business there, that it's kind of like, yep, you're in China too. That's, yeah, how's that going? And so, but it's also, I mean, in automotive, to play at the level we want to play, you have to have a global footprint. You have to show that you can speak to engineers in China, in Detroit, in Dusseldorf, et cetera. So you have to have this basic global footprint that allows you to operate regionally and, you know, on a global level. So we recognize that right off the bat as well, as, you know, if we're going to talk to these tier ones that have operations all over the world, they're not really going to want to talk to somebody that's in Zeeland, Michigan. They're not going to see the value in that. But if you know, present that global footprint, and yet we're in Shanghai, we're in Barcelona, we're in Mexico, we're in Michigan and near Detroit, it's kind of, okay, yep, good. You've got all the bases covered. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the strategy too.
Beautiful. And you've got a team spread out all over the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, some JV type relationships, other direct employees. How do you keep everybody on task? It's a huge, huge leadership question. You know, we have a hard enough time keeping people on task, you know, in the same county.
Yeah, it's and again, I think we were fortunate because we went global sooner than later that we were forced to try to figure out how to keep people aligned and keep people on the same page. So from the very beginning, we were implementing practices and tools that were essentially aimed at over communicating our direction. And so there's a lot of part of, again, why we embarked on this DPMC management by missions whole thing was because that is a methodology that we had been practicing within our own organization. And that's really a way of aligning everyone within the company toward a common direction or a common mission, common purpose, whatever you want to say, and cascading that throughout the entire organization so that everybody's kind of marching at least in the same direction. So that's, you know, we were practicing that from a very early age, just that idea of alignment and communication and communicating our purpose and our mission and our values, and this is who we are. And so that was a constant conversation going on, whether it was, you know, directly about that or in the background of other conversations we were having. It was always kind of there. And then we just set up tools and practices around that, you know, whether it was the rhythms that we established daily, weekly, monthly, the dashboards, the business reviews, all those things had intentionality around keeping people focused on where we were headed and then pulsing it in the organization, you know, rhythmically, whether it was daily or weekly, so that everybody, it was, you could argue it was to, you know, overkill or ad nauseum type of thing. But I don't know if you've ever read Vern Harnish, The Rockefeller Habits, mm-hmm. and some of those type of books. I would highly recommend Vern Harnish, and he's a competitor, dang it. I would highly recommend him. That is who we used at Venture Source in the very beginning. And he does this daily rhythm, weekly rhythm, top rocks, one page plan type stuff that really aligns small and large organizations. It doesn't really matter. Really aligns you toward your goals and the direction that you need to head. And that those practices are really powerful.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, I think this earlier this year we read Scaling Up, which I think is the what came after Rockefeller Habits, sort of an addendum to it. So yeah, phenomenal stuff there, and integrates beautifully into what I know you're now doing as a consultancy for DPMC. So can you talk to me about you sort of learn the hard way, right? Just by doing, which is how so much sticks to us and becomes part of us. It really was fundamental to your survival as a company. And now that's now permeating, that permeates your culture so much that it's now something that you can actually give to others outside of your organization through DPMC and through an alignment with a, you know, other people on the global scale. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us a little bit about DPMC? What's the mission there? You know, how is that going to impact people?
Let me step back a couple of years, because we wrote a vision for Venture Source, which was the primary company within a group of companies that we're managing. We wrote a vision for Venture Source, and then one of the vision's like, it's 3 pages long. It's made up of a bunch of different paragraphs. But one of the paragraphs was essentially saying something along the lines of, we have developed such a cool way of operating our business that we are going out into the world and teaching others how to do that, whether that's entrepreneurs, startups, whatever. We didn't know. When you write a vision, it's very vague. It's kind of out there. It just gives you direction. And so we said 4 years ago, we casted this vision out 10 years. And we're like, you know, in 5 years, we're going to be teaching others how we do business, because we think the way we do business is very powerful from a structural standpoint and allowing people to meet their potential, to flourish and all these things. So we want to teach others how to do that. And so, okay, I don't know what that was going to look like. And so you just kind of throw it out there to Providence and hope that something bubbles up and you're like, that's it. And that's what happened. DPMC bubbled up and we're like, that is it. Because we had spent a couple of years trying to craft like our own, it was almost like our own curriculum. We were like, okay, if we're going to teach another business how to, so they were kind of, the team was asking me, well, you know, what would that look like? So I'm crafting this curriculum. I'm like, boy, this is not what I should, like, I'm not good at this. So I was kind of spinning my wheels. And so we stumbled upon DPMC through some things that we were doing with Virtuous Leadership. And somebody pointed us to DPMC and said, hey, these guys in Spain have all the methodologies, the structures and practices to do kind of what you are hoping to do or what you you think you're doing. And so we checked it out and it was like, man, this is it. This is exactly what we would want to bring to others. So that's kind of where the idea started, from a vision cast. And then when we saw DPMC, it was a connecting of the dots. It was like, this is it. So that's what led us into that in a roundabout way. And so DPMC, actually it stands for Management by Missions. DPM is the Spanish for Management by Missions. And it's really that, you know, I referenced it above a little bit. I talked about it. It's what we use in our company and our group of companies. So there's a handful of companies within this group that we're part of that use these types of practices. But the overall value proposition for Management by Missions is creating unity. And when you create unity in teams, you increase performance. And there's a lot of writings out there recently. I think there's one in HBR that's coming out or just came out about this idea of unity and performance. So it's kind of timely that HBR is writing about this. But if you've ever played team sports or anything like that, you know that to be true, right? When your sports team is highly cohesive and connected and working as one, the performance is better. So the question is, how do you do this in business? And how do you get 1,000 people or 5,000 people aligned and headed in the same relative direction and working together in concert? And that's what we're excelling at doing. That's our proposition to the client, is that's where we can help. And so we work with businesses. Yeah, we provide them with the practices and the tools. We try to enhance this unity. And then we drive that down to each person within the organization. So it starts at a leadership level, but drives down to everybody, down to the operating level, or where the level, you know, where the execution is happening. And we help them assimilate the mission of the organization into their own personal mission. So there's an alignment of the person and the person's mission and the person's job to be done and where they think they can contribute. There's an alignment of that with the company mission. And those are the connections we try to make. And if you get a critical mass there, then you're starting to talk about Jim Collins' good to great type companies.
Yeah. So I what I really love about this whole approach is that not only are you consulting people on this on a regular basis now through DPMC, but you also have a laboratory where you're executing on it regularly. So you're constantly testing what you're preaching as well, what you're integrating into other companies as well,
yeah,
because you have this laboratory. And we've just talked about VentureSource, but you've got, I know that you mentioned that VentureSource is part of a larger sort of group, family of companies that are all aligned in their desire to this concept of management by missions, and mm-hmm. and you've even extended it to you know, these new startups and, you know, helping people get stuff off the ground in Guatemala, which I thought was amazing. Can you mentioned to me at one point in our conversations, you have a lens, sort of a three-dimensional lens of sorts that you, where you think about this whole paradigm of, you know, practicing what you preach. There's a funding side where you can invest in new ideas, and then a learning and teaching side, sort of the trifecta of things. Can you kind of bring us into that lens so that it makes sense for maybe a small business owner who's listening to this, and or maybe a larger business owner who, you know, needs consulting services?
Yeah, I mean, it's unique to the type of business maybe that you're starting or you're running. And it's something unique to us just because of how we hope to structure the business, because I never set out to create a large hierarchical company. The picture that I had on my head from the very beginning, we put it on paper, was this idea of a collection of businesses where people could learn, start and grow their own companies. So that was, from the very onset, it was heavy in this idea of how to structure it so that people could prosper, people could, you know, become all they could be, they could test themselves and so forth. So that strategy drove our vision, or that vision rather drove our strategy, and then that drove our structure. So we needed to figure out, you know, in our case, we needed to figure out for example, how to get ownership into people's hands in non-traditional ways, because we were structuring this collection of small businesses. That's the picture we had in our mind. And we wanted people to be owners in that and co-owners in that. You know, that's really where you allow people to really see what they can do. If you put them in those spots of challenge, I guess, or whatever, say it. So anyhow, so that structure, eventually we started talking about how would we structure that? And we started talking around three key pillars, one being practice what you preach, which you just kind of mentioned, which is, you know, what if we had a collection of businesses, small, medium, large, we didn't know, we just said a collection of businesses where we're actually practicing these things that we're learning and trying to instill in ourselves. Another pillar was learn and teach. So how are we going to do that? How are we going to continue to learn, and how are we going to take that learning and implement it back into the organizations that we're running? And then the bigger question was, how are we going to fund this picture? Like, how are we going to grow? Because organically growing may not be tenable. It may not even be feasible. We just didn't know how to do that. So we have this picture for funding and growing that is probably more aligned with maybe like a private equity type model, where we're going to structure access to funding that would, it could go into helping some of these businesses or add new businesses to the collection. So it's kind of a three-legged stool where we think we have all the pieces of the puzzle. It's not unlike large organizations. There's examples that I can give of organizations that have, you know, maybe they're conglomerate like, but they have multiple businesses, they have their own little university, and a couple of them even have these external funding things that help bring access to capital back into their group. I'm thinking of one in my head right now. I won't say it because I don't know that I can, but it's a similar structure to that. So it's not like this is a novel idea. It's really quite commonsensical, but that's kind of where we landed on that. And so Venture Source would be one of the businesses that practices what we preach. DPMC would be one of the businesses, or the business that does the learning and teaching, and the funding and growing. I'm still trying to figure that one out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it takes different, there's different iterations of that. First, you know, funding for Venture Source through banks and through, you know, through an initial incubation that at scale doesn't work, and now you've got to look at different things in order to fund different ventures as well. But it's that constant curiosity that I'm hearing that allows you to continue to just keep scaling. And one thing, Phil, that I think is really just really impactful for me is that you the metric that you keep using really is all about people. Like, how can we get more people to be more entrepreneurial through what we do? How can we get them ownership? Yeah.
So we had a mantra from the very beginning. And again, I don't know. Well, I know where this mantra came from, but we had a mantra from the very beginning that was essentially priority on the person. Hmm. Because I think part of the reason why we did that is because we grew up in the manufacturing world. Mm-hmm. Many of us and many of the team that was the leadership team that was with me at the time. And we knew how the companies that we had worked with put the priority on capital. They put the priority on everything but the person. And so we kind of swung that pendulum to the other side and said, whatever we do, it's going to be priority on the person first. That's got to be where we come from, because a business is a collection of people at the end of the day. That's kind of, if you look at the definition and go to the roots of company, that is, you know, the people breaking bread together idea. That was the intent of what a company was supposed to be. So for us, that was very natural and a good reminder to say, if we lose track of that priority on the person, then we're probably going down the wrong path, and it's probably going to lead to something that's not great, something that's not fun, or something that we're not proud of.
I know that you mentioned the Michelin story to me at some point. I know that was a big, obviously similar industry as well. Can you talk to me a little about, or share with us a little bit what you learned from that now family and what they're, you know, from their founding, you know, sort of the way they approach business and how that impacted what you've decided to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's a book that I read early on that was an interview of Francois Michelin talking about Michelin, you know, Michelin tires, mm-hmm. the big European company. But it was really an interview of him talking about his belief system in what, you know, what a company ought to be and a little bit in what leadership ought to be. And so he had a comment in there that stuck with me, which was essentially it's a privilege to be a leader, but it's also a responsibility. The leader's primary responsibility, he said, which is not something I learned in business school, but the leader's primary responsibility was to know the person, was to understand the person within the organization and to help them get to their full potential. That was the leader's ultimate responsibility. So he was very priority on the person focused. But this concept of what leadership is from his perspective against what I had learned in business school, which had talked nothing of that at all. I don't think I had any conversations around those types of discussions. It was all, you know, shareholder value. And it was what I would call it was tricks and tools and practices to, you know, that were more in line with manipulation than they were with, you know, authentically forming relationships and understanding people and their desires and where they ought to be. So this idea, this concept of this awesome responsibility that leadership had of putting this focus on the person and understanding that person deeply so that you could help that person get to their potential was really striking to me. And so I really latched onto that concept, and that started to form our belief system right from the beginning. And that, so you can see where that idea then bore itself out in the structure of the organization, because the structure wasn't hierarchical. It wasn't all about me. It was about forming a structure that allowed people to become all they could be. And so we thought, well, what's the best way to do that? But start a bunch of small businesses and let people run them.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it's just, you know, you can kind of connect the dots on that one, but that's where it began.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Phil, this is Mike jumping back in, but one of the things that Pat and I, one of our little mantras is always people over things.
Right? Yeah.
So we we always talk about that. It's really simple formulation, you know, and it's even more distilled than what your formulation is, a little bit more elegant. But it's a guiding star for us when we're thinking about how we're going to spend money, especially in, you know, as we're setting the budget for next year. I had one question from where we've gone with the podcast is, we've talked a lot about people with character as the driving force in your business. Where do you find these people? That's always my question, is where do you find them? And then when you hire them, how do you know what part of the organization or which organization they're going to be a part of?
Yeah, well, there's a website called peoplewithcharacter.com. Okay. No, I'm kidding.
That's the rock you didn't look under.
There probably should be. Actually, no, it's not. Again, I think it goes back to self-awareness. And I'm not, in this case, I'm not talking about individual self-awareness. I'd be talking about corporate self-awareness, if there's such a thing. But it's understanding the organization and what type of people and what type of character and temperaments would be successful in that organization, right? Because different organizations require different things of people. And so you may be, I don't know, maybe you are, you know, there's different personality tests that you can take, but maybe you need more, you know, in the DISC profile world, maybe you need more D's than you need I's or whatever, you know. But knowing your organization and what is successful there at least gives you a starting point to start to formulate that right in the hiring process, so that you can really start to narrow down the types of things that you need to see and find in people. And so the ironic thing is the resume is the commodity. It's like everybody has a resume and you can look through a resume in 3 minutes and okay, I got enough. Yep, the skill is there. And you can test, you can challenge for that skill. So you get a resume and you can go through and make sure that what's on their resume lines up with what they're saying and they actually have that. But that's like, you know, maybe that's 30% of the effort in our hiring process is validating the skill, you know, because if it's there on paper and you guys know your business, anybody can validate that in about 30 minutes. You just ask a few questions around how would you deal with this situation and tell me about that situation. And you get a flavor for if they're embellishing or not. So that's why I call it the commodity. That's an easy thing to do. The difficult thing to do is to start to qualify this person from a character standpoint and a behavioral standpoint. And I'm not talking about let's put them through a behavioral test. We don't do that, although some organizations do, and we have talked about that. We just have a simple, hungry, humble, and smart methodology. We use these three words. Are they humble? Are they hungry? And are they smart? And that's kind of how we approach it from those three perspectives. So we have people interviewing for humility. We have people interviewing for hunger, like you could say self-motivation, self-starters, that type of thing. How curious are they? How much learning are they doing on their own? And then smart is just, that would get back to the resume type thing. Can they do the job? Mm-hmm. So we just call them that. It's just kind of a simple way to remember it. But those are really the three areas that we're doing. But the humble and the hungry, that's a lot of character right there. Those are, so call it two-thirds, one-third. Two-thirds of our discussion with the person is around character and behavior.
Phil, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. And so thank you so very, very much. I know we're short on time, but before we head out, you mentioned a couple books. So Vern Harnish, Scaling Up is the new book. I think the Rockefeller Habits was the first one. And then the Michelin Interview. I don't know that book. I've heard it referenced by multiple people, and I've got to pick it up. So do you happen to remember what book that was in?
Yeah, it's the title of the book is called And Why Not?
And Why Not, okay.
Like, why not? With a question mark. So I don't know the author. It was an interview, and it's an easy read. So yeah, that book is up there. Another book that's up there on my list is, have you ever read Endurance, the Shackleton?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That journey to the South Pole thing. I always recommend that book to entrepreneurs because no matter how bad a day you're having, just read that book. It puts things in context. It's like, come on, man, it's not that bad. Really? Your business is failing. You're not stuck on an iceberg.
Although it feels that way sometimes. You
have to eat your dog.
Right. That's right. So
fantastic.
That would be the one I'd throw out there.
Well, great recommendations as well. Love it. And Phil, thanks again. It's been a real pleasure, and looking forward to gleaning some more from you in the years to come. But I really appreciate your generosity with us this morning.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, guys. It was fun. Thanks.
All right, buddy.
Thank you, Phil.
Take care. All right, guys. See ya. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. A big thank you once again to Phil for spending his valuable time with us on the podcast. Thanks again to you for listening, and for feedback on this episode or the podcast in general, email us at podcast@towerhillrealty.com.